This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
Now we're going to handle some trial advocacy tips involving all five of our panelists. And I would remind them that for the first five of these questions, you have a limit of 3 minutes. Judge Oker, what is the most common error made by prosecutors in an opening statement? Please.
All right. Well, I would say, in a nutshell, not telling a story. And that being said, I recognize that prosecutors have to give the quote-unquote roadmap of the case. They have to hit all of the elements, and they have to do it in a somewhat non-dramatic fashion. Mm-hmm. So they have to walk the line between a sort of monotone, you'll hear this person say that, and you'll hear that person say this, and crossing that line over into being dramatic. But nonetheless, I would say the failure to tell a story.
Okay. Judge Blitzman, what is the most common error made by defense counsel in an opening statement?
Well, first of all, you must make an opening statement if you're a defense attorney. Research shows that 70% of cases, although we tell jurors not to start deliberating until they've heard all the evidence, decisions are made after the openings. Jurors start forming an account, a narrative. So the biggest failing is related to what my colleague just discussed, which is an imperative for defense counsel, and that is to develop a narrative theme. To tell the jury right away what the theory of the case is, what's the theme, what's the tag, and then to make sure that as you plan your case, that that theme resonates throughout every direct and cross, and to bookend it at the close. You shouldn't oversell, however, in an opening, because you've got to be mindful about not shifting the burden of proof. So if you oversell about evidence that you think are going to come in, you may be diluting the benefit of the beyond a reasonable doubt burden of proof that the government always carries.
You've got a little extra time. Can you comment on the most common error by prosecutors in their opening, which Judge Oker has already commented
on? In my estimation, it's overselling. So I think a common error that I think younger prosecutors make is in their zeal to show that roadmap to build the wall, they offer to prove too much. And zealous defense counsel is sitting there, and at the end, they're checking off everything that they feel was not proven. Madam Prosecutor, Mr. Prosecutor said they were going to prove A, B, and C. They didn't do that. That's reasonable doubt. They didn't prove B. That's reasonable doubt. So it's important that the prosecutor does give a clear roadmap. They address the elements of the offense, but they not oversell. I've heard opening statements from prosecutors that have gone on for 45 minutes. I remember one in a Superior Court criminal case I had. My client was really dismayed. He said, "We're dead." I looked at him. I said, "No, I don't think so. I don't think that Clarence Darrow could meet that proffer." You know, so it's overselling, I think.
Great. Okay. Judge Tan, what is the best way that counsel for the prosecution or the defense or for in a civil proceeding in the juvenile court, what's the best way that counsel can enhance the credibility of a witness on direct examination?
If you're calling a witness on direct, that means that you have made the decision that this person is going to provide relevant and important information for your case. And so that's why it's essential, I think, for the fact finder to not just like your client, but to trust what, not client, but trust and like your witness, right? And so you have to prepare the witness. And I think that humanizing that person, and if it's an expert, obviously laying down the foundation and building up their expertise, if it's a professional witness. And I think it's important to make sure that the witness is not just going off and giving narratives as their answers, because, you know, I just read that the average attention span for human being, it has gone from 12 seconds in 2020 to 8 seconds. And so actually, just by my telling you that, I've already lost your, I think, attention span by, you know, already wasted 8 seconds. So I think it's important to remember that, because the fact finder, you know, those of us who've sat in trials where you sometimes hear the witness continue to go on and on and on, it's important for you as the person who called this witness to break up that narrative and just and take the opportunity to interrupt and just say, excuse me, officer, or, you know, I'm just going to interrupt you, Ms. Smith. Can you tell us what you meant when you said the car was red? And I think it's important because you want to draw attention to the facts that you want the fact finder to remember. And that's going to be easily lost if the person just continues on and on and on with their answer. So with that, I'm going to stop.
One thing that I find that enhances a witness's credibility on direct examination is if the examiner and the witness have kind of reached an agreement prior to the testimony that the witness will direct her answers directly to the attorney, but in a important part of the testimony, I'll often gesture and say, would you please tell these jurors what you were thinking at that very moment? And the witness knows she's going to look at the jury and say, provide that evidence, and that seems to embed that evidence into the jury's mind by having the witness directly give the answer to the jurors and then turn back and resume answering the questions directly.
Definitely.
To you. Judge Nielsen, what are the most effective arguments made by counsel to persuade you to give, quote, one last chance to a parent who has had an inconsistent history in dealing with a substance abuse or a substance use issue?
Okay. Well, that's a pretty complicated question. it depends on where we are in the proceedings. If we are at a termination trial, the court is going to look at those 14 factors and really consider what's best interest of the child. So as the case goes along, the court is constantly assessing where we are. Is this the type of case where, you know, we have a parent with a substance use disorder that is able to, first of all, have appropriate community support, clinical support, the bond that they already have with their child, also looking at family members. And I think it's also really important to understand that parents don't necessarily parent in a vacuum. Sometimes they have other reliable caretakers in their lives. So a one-off, and as we know, relapse is part of recovery, unfortunately. And so we can look at that clinically and see, is this is a person who is going to relapse once a year for a couple days, or is this person going to relapse for weeks at a time, every 6 months? So it really depends on the severity of the circumstance and where we actually are in the proceedings.
One effective argument I've made is that the court with a parent who has a substance use issue and has relapsed once or twice is to ask the court to look at the length of time between the relapses, so that if a person relapsed 3 weeks after beginning probation, okay, that's not good. But then probation was extended, and then it was 3 months before the next relapse. And they give one more chance, and then there's 10 months before the next relapse. Because I've heard many times from caregivers that it's not so much that a person relapses, but how long is in between the relapses, which really reflects the person's humanity and dedication to try to stay off the drugs. But it's a very, very tough issue for them to deal with. And the person who does do it for a longer time, for the third relapse, should be given credit, I think.
That's certainly considerations that we make all the time. One other issue is that, you know, the nexus between the use and how they've been able to care for the children. So if you have somebody who relapses, and in certain circumstances, that could be mitigated by the fact that maybe they weren't taking care of children at the time. Those issues, if you have a child that's otherwise being taken care of, is healthy, happy, and of an age where they can appreciate the situation that they're in with a parent that has this type of disorder, then, you know, the court can maybe give parents the benefit of the doubt. Certainly, if a parent has used their discretion to ensure that the children are taken care of if they have a relapse, then that's pretty strong evidence of a lack of a nexus.
Gotcha. Judge Torney, many trials reflect the use of demonstrative evidence. Can be photos or a map or some other something else that could aid the jury in understanding the trial. Can you tell us what is one way that counsel can be more effective at trial with demonstrative evidence, please?
Well, demonstrative evidence is pretty much anything that's not testamentary or in some cases documentary. It's photos, x-rays, videotapes, movies, sound recordings, anything that's physical in the courtroom. And it's useful to the trier of fact to show context after a witness has testified. Because it gives, well, the classic case is OJ. That was a pretty effective use of demonstrative evidence. And I think that may have been the thing that pushed the case over the edge. But effectively,
Your Honor, we may have lawyers who are unfamiliar with the case you're referring to and the demonstrative evidence that we all saw. So if you could just add a slight more context, please.
It doesn't say it must acquit. Everybody here knows the OJ case, right? No, maybe not. When he put on gloves that were allegedly used in the murder, and they didn't fit him, and the prosecution had hung a lot of their case on the fact that these were the gloves that were worn in the murder, and OJ couldn't even get them on. So, I mean, that went a long way to blowing a hole in the prosecution's case. But effective demonstrative evidence should be simple and clear. And at the end of the display, there should be no need for further comment. It's a drop the mic moment if you do a good job with your demonstrative evidence. And waiting a minute or two and looking at the jury, that goes a long way to selling what you just were trying to sell. Hopefully, of course, your demonstrative evidence goes well. Demonstrative evidence is most accurately reflects a witness's testimony, and it's more probative than prejudicial. That's one of the things that you're looking for when you decide that you're going to use demonstrative evidence. Those, I find the most effective thing I ever saw was one of those day in the life videos that in a civil case where someone was paralyzed and they showed the day-to-day activity of the woman getting up, people helping her, getting bath, trying to eat her breakfast, couldn't move her arms. I mean, that's the kind of demonstrative evidence that you really can't buy. It's of course, has to be authenticated. It has to be admissible, you know, that type of thing as well. But I find PowerPoint evidence boring. I find charts boring. A lot of times the lawyers come in and they got the whiteboard and they're drawing where the kid was sitting when he hit the girl in the head. And it's hard to even tell what they're trying to explain. They'd be much better off just letting the kids testify as to who was sitting where and when. So I find that stuff boring, and I'm sure a jury does too. So that having been said, is I think you have to put some thought into it. You have to make sure you can get it into evidence. But there are a number of ways that you can be effective with that. But you might have to spend some money as defense counsel if you really want to impress the finder of fact, especially in a jury trial, when oftentimes in a juvenile case, if it's been going on a while, you're pretty sleepy.
One of the things I've found to make more effective use of demonstrative evidence is not to put all of it in immediately as it's going along with the witness narrative. What I've found effective is to have a witness give an oral testimony of what he or she is describing at the scene. And then when she completes that, then I approach to show her photographs of it that allow jurors to get a much better impression of it. Then I have the person look at a map and designate where these people were. And then finally, I showed a videotape of the accident caught by a neighbor who had a camera outside the house. And the prosecutor kept objecting, saying, asked and answered, and the judge had to say, no, he hasn't asked the witness yet about a photograph, or yes, he hasn't asked a witness yet about drawing it on a diagram, and no, he has not asked it before if he's now asking to show the videotape. So that seemed to be a more effective way to use multiple demonstrative evidence tools for a single event.
You know, all right, Judge Oker, demonstrative situations in our court.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Your Honor.
We don't get too many demonstrative evidence cases in our court.
Well, maybe you'll find it with different attorneys.
Perhaps.
Yep. Judge Oker, what are the most effective arguments made by counsel for the Department of Children and Families to persuade you not to give, quote, one last chance to a parent who's had an inconsistent history dealing with a substance use issue?
All right. Well, of course, you can take what Judge Nielsen said and sort of flip it the other way. But I think number one is what I think Judge Nielsen ended with, which is establishing very clearly the connection between the substance use and the risks to the child or the children. I think sometimes that is not, well, it's definitely not always done effectively or sufficiently. The substance use is established, the lack of supports, all those things that have already been referred to, you know, the lack of supports, the repetitive history. But, you know, there is some power to the argument relapse is part of the condition or disease. And I think that needs to be countered powerfully with the connection to the risk to the child. And embedded into that is, you know, the child can't be made to wait for the hope that the parent is going to adequately address the issues. I mean, given the right evidence, obviously, it's all going to come down to the facts. So
great. Thank you.
Okay.
Judge Blitzman, what is the most effective argument made by counsel in a close case when you were sitting in order to persuade you not to impose detention on a juvenile in a youthful offender prosecution?
So I'll begin that by saying that some of the same considerations that were addressed in the very informative Brangen bail conversation that my colleagues had earlier, you're talking about a youthful offender allegation, so The question then becomes, was a motion filed under 276, section 58A for a dangerousness hearing? So if you're talking about dangerousness, that's a different situation. But if absent that, then the same bail statute applies, notwithstanding that it's youthful offender allegation. 276, chapter 276, section 58, presumption of personal recognizance. And the salient issues are likelihood of court appearance. There's a danger to assume that because there's a serious charge, that bail is necessary. That does compromise the presumption of innocence, and it runs the risk, of course, of criminalizing poverty. And that's a big issue. I think this was addressed earlier. The question of the necessity for bail in juvenile cases is constantly being revisited. The research shows that juveniles rarely default. So is bail even necessary in juvenile cases, absent dangerousness scenarios? So, you know, confinement is necessary in some situations, but only if there's a palpable public safety issue, because if you disconnect youth from schools, community, the things they need for social connection, the social tissue that they need, you actually do the reverse of what you're trying to do, which is you're increasing the likelihood of recidivism by making those disconnects. Research shows that kids do better in the community, and that detention correlates with higher levels of recidivism. So there's a meeting here between what's good for positive youth development and also what best protects public safety.
Excellent. Thank you. Judge Tan, what is the most important trial advocacy tip you can offer counsel in making their closing arguments before you?
So in bench trials for civil cases, unfortunately, sometimes those cases can take some time to conclude once they've begun. And it's not unusual sometimes for us to be hearing closing arguments, you know, a couple months after we first started the evidence. And so I think it's important, and unfortunately, again, sometimes those cases are tried over the span of several months, and maybe with one day here, one day there, and a little bit disjointed. And so I think it's important to summarize your important, salient, relevant, critical points that you want to remind the judge of that maybe, you know, was given in testimony a couple months ago. And so I would not sort of try and go give a narrative from beginning to end. I would pick out your important points. And if there's relevant case law, that is always helpful for me.
Thank you. Judge Nelson, what do counsel do that most irritate the jury during a trial?
Well, I think it's human nature to be irritated by certain things. And even though, I mean, several points were made prior to, and you want to keep the jury's attention, you want to make it interesting without being bombastic, I guess is another term. So I think towards those ends, anything that counsel does to look like they're wasting time, I think probably irritates the jury. Any unnecessary bickering in front of the jury, I can't imagine that, and I haven't seen it, but I can imagine that would be extremely irritating and unprofessional. Any condescending remarks to directed to or about the defendant, victims, condescending toward the court, just basic disrespectful behavior, I think, would probably irritate a juror.
Thank you very much. That's good to know. And Judge Torney, what do counsel do that most irritate a judge during a trial?
Where do I begin? Cell phones under the counsel table, texting back and forth with their friends, being an okay lawyer. Where did you first see the defendant? Across the street, okay? And when you saw him across the street, what was he doing? He had his hand in a basket. Okay. And every single answer is answered with okay. And all of us, I think, know those people who just can't leave it alone, and they have to say okay after every single answer. Drives me crazy. I don't say anything about it because I know people are nervous and I know people need time to think about what the next question is going to be. But they say okay after every single question, and that's just nutty. The other thing that's not necessarily a trial issue was don't be a head note lawyer. Don't read the head note of a case and think you have the full impact of what the case means. Lawyers are great copiers, and they copy from their friends. They copy from briefs that they've done before. And sometimes they don't, the case doesn't necessarily fit the facts, or B, they haven't even read the case, and they assume that the judge hasn't read the case either. And I wouldn't assume that from any of my colleagues, especially when we get the information the night before and we can prepare for court the next day. You know, more times than not, I said, well, that's what the first part of the case says, but did you read the second part of the case? Well, of course I did, Judge. Well, if you had, you would have come up with a different conclusion as to whether or not this case fits what you're trying to tell me. And then the last thing is on care and protection cases, on pretrial conferences, what happens if the DCF lawyer gets up and she reads the report that I've already read? And then the defense attorneys read the report, portions of the report that are favorable to their client, and they read that from the report that I've already read. So in pretrial conferences, all I really need to know is, you know, how old is the case? I've read the report. I know whether mom's doing well. I know whether dad's doing well. I know if the DCF worker's not doing her job as far as reasonable efforts are concerned. But I don't need you to repeat all of that at a pretrial conference. We could do it much faster if we just moved along. I guess that's it.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was a very helpful narrative about what things counsel do that most irritate a judge.